The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. So this morning for our first Taisho, or Dharma talk, of our Sesshin, all three of the teachers are going to offer something. We joked earlier in the officers' meeting that we'd all be talking at the same time. But we decided on further reflection that it would be better to take turns. So I got the short straw, and I'm going to start. A couple of words about a Taisho or a Dharma talk, just to remember to stay in your upright sitting posture throughout the talk, and to allow the words to come to you as if everything that we say was intended only for you. It's a kind of mysterious thing. One thing that might happen is that you'll be listening to the talk and absolutely none of it will make any sense whatsoever. And that's fine. You don't need to make sense of it. But what we'd like to encourage you to do is to allow yourself to receive the words and just notice what the reaction of hearing these words is in your body, your heart, and your mind. You don't have to figure anything out. This is not a lecture. This is an expression of the unexpressible using words, because that's what we've got as human beings. And one of the treasures of our Boundless Way Zen tradition comes from koans that were collected probably towards the end of the 11th and 12th centuries about the sayings and doings of people who lived many centuries before that. These stories, we call them koans, which just means a case, an exemplary case, something to look at, something to wonder about together. We often use the same one for a sesshin, so we'll be talking about it this morning and most likely also tomorrow morning, and maybe our senior Dharma teachers will even refer to it. That's up to them when they give their encouragement talks this evening. So I'm going to read through the koan that we chose, and we chose it last night, the three teachers, when we were a little bit tired and leafing through koan collections, and finally, oh, this one. And then when we all studied it further, we thought, wow, this one. We were very impressed with the way things sometimes work out. So as I read it to you, to start off with, again, remembering that you don't have to understand it. This is a story about, actually there are four characters in the story, and a fifth one if you include the collector of the story who makes a comment at a certain point. The collector and the person who wrote the poems that also are included sometimes in cases, his name was Hungjer, and we read something from him earlier this morning in our sutra service. So there's a little bit of a comment from Hungjer, who lived hundreds of years after this whole thing happened, and a comment by another teacher who wasn't even there. But the main characters are three people, a teacher and two of his students. And the teacher was named Dao Wu, and we'll just call him Wu for the sake of this story. And the students were Chen Yuan, who we'll just call Yuan, and Shi Shuang, who we'll just call Shuang. So Wu and Yuan and Shuang. And it begins with Wu and Yuan going to a house to make a condolence call. Someone had died in the house. In those days, Buddhist priests didn't do funerals as they do now. This was just a friendly gesture on their part. So that's how it starts. Dao Wu and Chen Yuan went to a house to make a condolence call. Yuan, the student, hit the coffin and said, "Alive or dead?" Wu said, I won't say alive, and I won't say dead. Yuan said, why won't you say? Wu said, I won't say. Halfway back, as they were returning, Yuan said, tell me right away, teacher. If you don't tell me, I'll hit you. Wu said, you may hit me, but I won't say. Yuan then hit him. Just a brief moment here. In those days, it was really bad to hit your teacher. I would say the same thing holds now.
I was going to say.
But interestingly, what's not in the koan here is that the teacher said to a student, Yuan, after he'd been hit, you know what, I think you're going to get in trouble. I think you should leave. And he did leave the monastery, had all kinds of adventures, and then part two. Later, Dawu died, the teacher. Yuan went to his Dharma brother, Shixuan, who was also the Dharma heir of Dawu, and he brought up the story of going to the condolence call, and I won't say, I won't say. Xuan said, I won't say alive, and I won't say dead. Yuan said, why won't you say? Xuan said, I won't say, I won't say. At these words, Yuan had an insight. One day, Yuan took a hoe into the teaching hall and crossed back and forth from east to west and west to east. Xuan said, what are you doing? Yuan said, I'm looking for relics of our late master, Dao Wu. Xuan said, vast waves spread far and wide, foaming billows flood the skies. What relics of our late master are you looking for? Shui Do added a comment saying, heavens, heavens, or sometimes, alas, alas. Yuan said, this is exactly where I need to apply effort. And then later, Fu of Dayan said, the late master's relics are still present.
Melissa said that last night the three teachers got excited about this koan. Actually, one teacher scratched his head and said, huh? So, here we are listening to a story that on the surface of it makes absolutely no sense, as so many of the koans do not. How do we find our way in? How do we unlock the richness of these koans that have come to us across centuries because they're trying to convey something so vital? And so, my own experience is that I let the koan hit me over the head. What is it? What just hits me over the head with its puzzling nature, its opaqueness? And of course, the first thing that strikes me is this question, alive or dead? They're at a home making a condolence call. There's a coffin. Alive or dead? What is Dao Wu doing? What are the ancients asking us to look at? This question of alive or dead is sometimes referred to as the great matter. The great matter of life and death, of what it means to be here in this world, having a precious awareness for just an instant, so to speak. What does it mean that we are here? And so all of us come in some form or another to Zen with that question. is life? What is death? Who am I in this seamless body of all living things that pass quickly from dark to dark? And of course, alive or dead seems so clear. The person in the coffin is dead. But when Dao Wu does not answer, he invites us to look further. And that's what we're doing here for 3 days. We're looking deeply. So, alive or dead, all around us the leaves are turning. A leaf is on a tree, it's green, and then it begins to get yellow, and then it begins to get a little darker, and then its hold on the branch loosens, and then it floats down to the ground, and then, gradually, it becomes mulch, and it feeds the next crop of leaves. When is the leaf alive, and when is it dead? Where is the point where it moves from alive to dead? When we look deeply, we see that all of this is seamless, that all of the yes, no, right, wrong, alive, dead, from one perspective, of course it's clear, from another, seamless. And the other thing that leaps out at me as a gate into this koan is the urgency with which Yuan asks his question. He's saying, I've got to know. Tell me, which is it? Is it this or that? Is it dead or alive? Is it right or wrong? Do I take this job or that job? Do I leave my partner or do we stay together? All these urgent, urgent questions that seem momentous. I suspect that each one of us came to this sesshin with some urgency somewhere. And it's that urgency that fuels this investigation. And what does Dao Wu do? He does not answer the question. He doesn't say, well, it's a dead body in there. He lets the question hang. And he lets Yuan stew and look and churn with the question. Who am I? What is life? And it is that churning that is the richness of this koan that it brings up for us. The urgency to know, to solve, to get it right, to nail it down. And then we're invited to this deeper investigation into a world that is so much bigger and so much more alive. Why won't you say, Wu said. Wu said, I won't say. And halfway back, Yuan said, tell me, teacher, if you don't tell me, I'll hit you. And Wu said, you may hit me, but I won't say. So, I am not going to say, but now David Reinick is going to continue the talk, and maybe he'll say.
So let me explain it to you. if I could, I would. If I could explain it, it would not be the Dharma. If you could understand it, it would not be life itself. The direction here is into the heart of things, and in the heart of things, there is no one standing outside with the commentary. Our wonderful minds, our astonishing minds that are aware that we are here, aware that we are in the middle of this incomprehensible universe. You know, as a child, we might have asked, what's after infinity? What's at the edge of the universe? Because we cannot comprehend, our mind cannot comprehend the vastness of life itself. So we make up these categories. We make up time, past, present, and future. We make up space. All of these things, and then we struggle with what we have made up. And this invitation in this koan and in our practice is to enter into the heart of that which we do not know. At its heart, at its essence, Zen is not a way of increasing your understanding. It is not a way to gain control over your life. In case you haven't noticed, you do not have control over your life. You may have had some intimations of this as you have gone through your years and decades. Our life is unfolding, and we do not get to decide what we encounter. This encounter with life is the encounter with death, because of course there is no life except as it is supported by death. I remember once taking a walk with my teacher, George Bowman, and we were walking under this great and mighty oak tree, a live oak down in Florida. And we were talking about death, about the impermanence of things. And he said, we all imagine we are afraid of death, but imagine if you didn't die. Imagine if it went on forever, and the challenge of that, the horror to see everything come and go, and you not. But fortunately, all of us are part and parcel of this coming and going, the great rising and falling, the great in-breath and the great out-breath. All of us here on this beautiful spinning speck of dust in the middle of the vast universe. All of us like the speck of dust on the flea, on the dog, dreaming our dreams of struggle, dreaming our dreams of accomplishment. And all of this in vast space. Alive or dead? Is it this or is it that? Please tell me. And this a wonderful student, this wonderful student who makes a fool of himself, knocking on the coffin. They're there paying a condolence call. And what's he doing messing around? Grief is not something to trifle with. And so dreaming into him, as we're encouraged, to dream into all of the characters in these stories. And of course, we might start with the one in the coffin. You're just died, and some crazy Zen monk knocks on the coffin. Alive or dead? Well, stupid, I'm dead. Don't you know? But this monk who knocks, who asks this foolish question. But for me, I assume that he was dead serious, as we say. He was tormented. He was wondering about this great matter of life and death. If it all ends, where do we go? When it all ends, what? So why do anything? Why bother? Why sit long hours on the cushion and make myself, make my knees hurt? And in his great urgency, as Bob said, in this great urgency, he began to see quite clearly that he did not know. And so we come with the question, we all want something. If you didn't want something, you wouldn't be here. You must want something. If you are not clear about what you want, you will simply be carried away by causes and conditions. But in Zen, the teaching is that if you clarify what it is you're really after, not on maybe on the surface. Well, I'd like to have a house on the coast of Maine, and what would that give you? Well, it would give me a lovely view of the ocean, and what would that give you? It would give me a sense of the vastness of life. And what would that give you? And asking, what is it you really want amid all of the coming and going? For me, I want to be intimate with life. I want to be wholehearted at every moment. I want to not waste a moment of this precious miracle. We say, where is the Dharma? Where is the miracle? Where is awakening? It is right here. It does not look any different if you are waiting for the fruits of your practice. You are missing the banquet. Practice is not something we do for a while and then we get something out of it. Although there are fruits, we do grow in our love and understanding, our capacity, but more important than any change is to begin to see what has always been here. This vast life that is life and death, not two separate things, but this great arising and falling away. Many of us like to participate in the rising, in the birth. But in Zen, we are invited to participate in the dying, invited to participate in the falling, in the mistakes. The Buddha said, every compound thing, everything is constantly falling apart. So we are invited, we invite you to be urgent about your life. It will be over soon, soon enough to enter where you are, to knock on your life, knock on your life and death. And investigate the matter for yourself. Thank you. So I invite you to sit comfortably. You can turn this way if you'd like. We'll now have our Dharma dialogue, which is an opportunity to ask questions that the teachers will not answer, or to share how this story touches you, what you understand, what you don't understand. And just to remind you that we do record these Dharma talks and Dharma dialogues. If there's something you'd like to say and not have it recorded, you can let us know and we'll briefly turn off the recording and then turn it back on.
Thank you. As far as commenting on living your life wholeheartedly, I notice that when I travel, I go overseas, I come back, life suddenly is more vibrant, it's more alive. Same thing with these sashins. When I come back from the sashin, suddenly the complacency has turned into vividness. So, I appreciate all that, but it makes me wonder, why can I not sit on the North Fork of Long Island for a year and have every moment that sort of vibrancy? Mm-hmm. Why is it that I seem to need to go to a sashin or go to a country overseas to really appreciate where I had been previously? So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm going to answer that question. I was tempted to say I won't say, but I think that would be a cop-out at this point for the three of us. Nothing compounded, what is it?
No compound things.
No compound thing lasts, right? Nothing lasts. Not even the sense of vividness.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting, if that's what we're aiming for, then we'll be very disappointed when everything becomes complacent. We believe that the complacency is not the manifestation of the Dharma. Because the vividness is so cool. Yeah. And complacency isn't cool, but without complacency we wouldn't be able to drive cars. Can you imagine?
Yes.
The vividness of getting in the car and, oh, I can feel my foot on the pedal and my hand and this is so amazing. Well,
yeah. Well, that's cool. Complacency is just as genuine and real as the vividness.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing it up. But I also think, though, that it's a common misperception, especially in the world today where there's so much energy devoted to some kind of perfectionism. And if so, it could be called vividness, it could be called calmness, it could be called mindfulness, serenity. You know, we all have our own words. When David was going through the thing about the house on the coast of Maine, I was thinking, I just want peace. Peace. Forever. Oh, wait.
You know, Bill, the other thing I realize is that we will often say, be present for each moment. And I remember when I was first hearing the Dharma, I was at a conference where these very senior teachers, three of them up front on a panel, and one was saying, you can get to a place where you are mindful and present in every moment, and the other two were going... So I think that it's just a reminder that peace doesn't last, vividness doesn't last, being able to pay attention in each moment isn't possible.
And people who have come before us, great practitioners, have found this need to retreat. So this form of sashin is actually designed for human beings. To actually step aside. So we will get carried away. We will forget. It's not really a problem. It's just the way it is. So what is it that brings us back? And it may be, well, I find if I sit every morning, I'm actually more appreciative of my life. I find if I set aside the time and come and do this intense work, I clear my head a little bit. So we do these things to help ourselves. Hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, William, great.
That's
yeah, it. Right. Bill and William, we decided to differentiate you.
Yeah. I go by Bill.
Bill and Will.
Bill.
I actually just wanted to, if I may, piggyback on what you were just saying. I had the good fortune to do a summer training period with Robert Aitken Roshi years ago, and he told me a story that he, in the early sort of wild days of the Maui Zendo in the 70s, he was talking to one of the students, and he made the comment, well, you know, I don't know what context, but Aitken Roshi said, well, you know, you can't stay high all the time. And I looked at him very weirdly, and then he found out later on the fellow had just had a huge, like, a thousand bumper stickers printed up saying, stay high all the time. the thing I wanted to ask is, complacency, yeah, it's hard to say yes to everything. What if they're afraid? I think, you know, you could say, well, you say yes to the fear, but that's easier said than done. Or what if you're really quite clear that you have some psychological stuff that is really holding you back. Do you do your psychological stuff first? No, or you could be in doing that until you die, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe you'll be hit by bus tomorrow. So, what about that? What about this feeling that there are actual obstacles and there is some sort of progression and maybe you're not ready or maybe you can't do it just yet?
Well, I do both. I'm a psychiatrist, this has been a really active, lively area for me of investigation. Like, what about that? That's such an important question. And I think that, you know, it's not either or. For most of that some obstacles are so big that we can't sit, for example. So some distress is so great that this is not a time to sit. And so we take care of that distress in other ways. You know, it might be by some kind of health care. It might be, you know. But that what I have found is that giving ourselves permission to see what's here right now, if sitting is overwhelming because the distress is too great, then that's what's here. And we go do something else to take care of it. And then we can come back. But so in other words, it's always trying to encounter each moment, as we say, and make our best judgment about what to do when. And often it's both. I mean, often I will suggest to people that they find some kind of mental health care, and they still sit, right? And I'm using mental health care. You're talking about other obstacles as well, right?
But,
yeah.
You know, I've been, in the back of my mind, the word complacency, it keeps dancing around. And I'm realizing that I think there is a tendency in human beings to be complacent. The vividness is an exception, right? So the arising of fear, for example, is another way of engaging with vividness. We call it a Dharma door. Everything that arises is a Dharma door, but generally human beings flatten. You know, what did Thoreau say about people lead lives of
quiet desperation.
Right, really quiet. So one of the things that also happens in going to a foreign country, doing something brand new, coming to Sesshin, this kind of exceptional thing that isn't our ordinary life, is that those experiences can generate the vividness, which is not always nice. Right? So anger might arise, fear, as you said, great sadness and despair. That, by the way, can happen during a weekend retreat. Those of you who've been to Sesshin before, retreat, we've decided on the Sesshin committee, is a very bad word for what we're doing here.
It's
really turning towards the vividness of our lives. And the job of the teachers is actually to keep saying, oh, it looks like you're turning away. Look at this. And I don't wanna. You know, and it's kind of wonderful in this story that the student, as David said, is a wonderful student. He really wants to know, and he stays engaged, which is also important. Mm. That's why we have Doksan, you know. Mm. You can go through the whole retreat, the whole sesshin, and maybe go to Doksan once. But it dishonors that quality of engagement from both the student and the teacher. You know, the saddest thing for me is when students turn away. A wise man once said that you can't talk to somebody who's walking away from you. And there we are, sitting face to face. And as a student, I remember trying to put up all the walls and defenses I possibly could so that I wouldn't be seen. And meanwhile, my first teacher, my second teacher, my current teacher always saw through it. But, you know, they'd wait until the vividness came up. So I might come into a Doksan really upset, really. And then there's something to work with. Yeah. So I think everything is a Dharma door, this fear, everything. And just to loop it back, mental health care is essential for human beings, just like physical health care is essential. And just like brushing our teeth is essential. We have to keep doing all these things to care for ourselves so that we can do this deep dive into vividness. Thank you.
I want to thank you for choosing this koan just for me. That was extremely helpful.
Welcome.
Thank you. I was really struck, David, by, and Melissa just mentioned this, by the intensity of the student question, which I had been thinking about because on the second flight here from Oklahoma, there was a medical emergency on the flight.
Oh my gosh.
And it was one of those moments where all of a sudden they said, we need a doctor at 25C. And so I spent about 20, 30 minutes asking exactly that question.
Right. Alive or dead.
Alive or dead.
Yeah. And trying to read it based on who's going to walk on the plane and are they going to bring in this or that. And,
yeah.
Wow. And so the alignment, I guess, of that experience with this koan, it reminded me that the students are always fantastic in the koans. They're stupid.
Yeah.
They're laying it out.
They're laying it out.
And there's something about the rare opportunities for ineptitude that these events provide. Melissa and David know I've not been able to do this for a very long time, and so I'm feeling very emotional about being here. And I'm just screwing up left and right. Love it. and the idea of a koan that connects that kind of moment to moment humanness with the big question with a capital B and a capital Q. It's quite wonderful. So thanks.
Yeah. You know, I just thought that phrase, rare opportunities for ineptitude, that's how we should advertise it.
Thank you.
I think that comes into the category of breaking down that we want to enter through our competence.
Mm.
We would like to be a quite good Zen student, thank you very much, right? And do it right, and to really see that your competence and your all the things you value about yourself will not help you, because there's something so much more wonderful than whatever you think you have that is not limited in any way. And we enter through one mistake after the other. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
I kind of hear this mirror koan that I can imagine where the student asks the teacher, am I alive or am I dead?
Mm.
And the teacher again would say, I won't say. And that's kind of where I hear the urgency from the student, right? Because when we see dead people, that kind of supports our idea of aliveness. And then to see that the thing that you're not is not dead. And the student's kind of asking, am I alive? Right?
Mm-hmm.
And here, dead is an idea of like just not having will, not having free will in that sense, right? And then just being part of the flow of causation. And
right.
Is that different for the dead guy, the alive guy?
Yeah.
And that's kind of terrifying for the student, right? And
of course.
Yeah, you hear that.
Yeah, it's wonderful when we hear the koan like that, like as we get into it. These are not trick stories, actually, but they're stories about what it really means to be human. And often help us get down to layers that usually, well, we're too busy to think about this, but yeah, am I part of the flow of things? If I'm part of the flow of things, do I have any control over anything? In that very personal way. Quite wonderful. Thank you.
Paul? And
thank you for all your talks and all of the comments up until this point. It's interesting that as you begin, Melissa, it's like, oh, okay, here's a koan. And I have a story about myself. And so when I hear a koan, it's like, oh, here's another koan. Something that I'm going to stumble with, fumble with, and ultimately struggle with. That's there. And I love the presentations that each of you gave. And I'm still sitting here with this story of, how can I get in? How can I dream myself into it? That's there. And then we have this opportunity to come into the Dharma dialogue, and I look at the teachers, and what I see is morning glories.
They're behind us.
Oh, I thought you were calling me a morning glory.
Well, you are.
That was wonderful. That was great.
There's my answer. I just love that because I've been struggling with various things, especially this past week, and the tendency in the middle of struggle is to focus inward, to narrow, right? And here you are. Oh, I'm not good at koans or whatever it is. This little narrative you make about yourself, and then you're looking, and then your view is so broad that you see the morning glories out on the porch. This is what I also think the vividness. These words, we don't want to get too stuck in them, like alive or dead. You don't get stuck there either. That's a lot what this koan's about. Don't get stuck. Don't get stuck in the narrative. Don't get stuck in the difficulty. Remember that the world is vast and wide. This is really, and that's what one of the reminders of being on retreat. We're very focused. We're not looking around, hopefully. We're looking down, and we're just really focused. But then that allows a moment. We look up, morning glories. And, normally you probably, how many times have you come on the porch and seen the morning glories?
I know.
Yeah, many, many times. And yet, morning glories. So there's the vividness out of the complacency. And it just like life without death, vividness without complacency. You have to go through the, I don't get koans piece to open. Thank you. I know Jordan had his hand up. Did you?
In my understanding of the koan, we all face like this great matter of life and death, and there's no one permanent right answer, so we can't give an answer, we won't say. So I'm wondering, like, the student doesn't know the answer, and the teacher won't say, so like, what is the difference between the two people? Like, why does one end up resorting to violence? I guess I'm just like, I feel like neither of them have an answer, but they both encounter that so differently, and I'm wondering what that difference is.
Well, so I would say the teacher not saying does not imply there is not an answer. And we would say there actually is an answer, or might be millions of answers to this question. One of the positions of the teacher is that In the usual teacher-student relationship, the teacher has your answer, and you have to figure out what they're thinking, or get them, trick them into telling you what the answer is.
Not Zen teachers, hopefully. We're talking about regular school teachers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the answer, there is an answer that no one can tell you. Because it's not that kind of thing. And so it's easy, and my first take on most of these Zen teachers in the koans is that they're just being jerks. Right? Just torturing the poor students. You know, don't be tricky and give me this Zen bullshit, tell me. But I think as we go deeper, it might be that the teacher is unspeakably kind. Kind to allow the student to stew, knowing that your awakening is not about anybody else. So the teacher is not the one who has your answer. The teacher might be the one who believes you have your answer and trusts you enough not to try to explain it to you.
You know, and Jordan, I might add to this that perhaps the difference between the student and the teacher is the intensity of the student's story. He has a story that the answer is there and this guy can give it to me. And there is one answer. And we all come with I have these very intense stories. And then practice and working with teachers and this Sesshin breaks down these stories. I mean, this, you know, and that's part of what seems to me happened with this student over time, that his certainty of what had to be out there and who could give it to him broke down. And with that, his heart broke open in the best way.
Yeah.
Oh, every time I hear complacency, what's coming up for me is, you know, how it doesn't work. And I don't think the first noble truth. That you know, the Buddha's father tried to engineer this artificial world of total complacency for the Buddha so that he would not become, so he wouldn't ask these questions, you know, and it didn't work. All you needed was one peep outside the palace doors to stop being complacent, to see the flames that were coming up everywhere, you know, in this world on fire. And, you know, what I'm really resonating with in the koan is the beginning of it. And we're kind of being a little hard on old Yan Yuan, but, you know, he comes with this great lack of complacency, this great, you know, this, you know, alive or dead, and you know what, this isn't a dorm room late night bullshit question.
Right.
It's like, you know, this is eating my heart out. And this is the molten ball that's stuck in my throat that I can't swallow or cough out.
Yeah.
You know, I'll hit you if you don't. You know, alive or dead. So I'm just really resonating with that. And it's really getting my kind of respect. You know, and I see the teacher, the future teacher who, you know, will find the relics of his teacher in that very, you know, lack of just clarity that there's no complacency, really.
And if you think about it, too, all through the koan, he demonstrates it in all these different ways. You know, I love what you said about there are answers, there are millions of answers. He gives 4, 5, 6 maybe distinct answers. You know, he hits his teacher, he leaves, he comes back, he asks again, it's still alive for him after all those years. Even though the teacher's dead now. And is the teacher dead? You know, that's also, where's the teacher? Where are the bones of the teacher? You know, he's dead. Really? And all this, and then the walking around with the hoe, and, you know, he's really, like, got a lot of vividness, that guy. So I think you're catching on. I think we're all maybe catching on to that as a real important prerequisite for the way. We have to want to know. Yes, and then yes.
I particularly appreciated that you just touched on something that's been kind of like mulling in my head, and I haven't quite known how to pick it out. But it seems to be that it's like purposefully one of those like circles that just keeps going and going and going, because you start with the question of alive and dead, and then the teacher dies, and then he comes back, and then there's answers, but he's looking for them still, and then if he goes on and there's not really quite an answer to that question, you can see the students eventually asking the same question, and then they die. It just seems that it's inevitable that this question will persist, and
yes.
I like that even you get to the end, and he's walking around looking for the relics, and they're like, well, they're already there.
Yeah.
And it just seems to be that the answer just keeps going around and around, but that seems to be its own kind of answer.
Right.
And so I just like that the teacher, like, dies and does the thing and seemingly answers the question, but that doesn't solve it.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm. So, it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes when we work with koans, and of course, your real koan is your life, right? The real story that you need to investigate. But sometimes we say that the koan is in resolution, that there are answers to koans. They aren't what you think they are, but there are moments when it's very clear. And then that clarity breaks apart. That clarity, too, is impermanent. So I think moments for all of us when, okay, my life makes sense, you know, and then you get out of bed and, you know, stub your toe, right? So, but I love what you're seeing about this is that there is no arrival except here.
You think that you got it there.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
For
and
a second.
You do. You truly have it. People say, well, I guess it must not have been true. No, no, no. The truth does not fixate. It's not something that you get and then you put in your pocket, but it is totally available and of immense importance and ungraspable, we say. Yeah.
I also had just the quick thought that all these people in the story are dead,
mm-hmm.
right? But they're very alive for us.
Yeah.
We're still talking
about it. Right, yeah. So, Owen, you had your hand up?
Yeah. Thank you for the talk. A talk I had heard where teacher read out a koan, and then towards the end they said, you know, this doesn't mean that you have to become some Zen weirdo. And I appreciate this koan is a bit of an antidote to, and maybe not, you know, maybe it's just a matter of my limited number of koans that I've looked at, but usually the master is the weirdo. Usually, it seems to me, usually, it's a very reasonable question that the poor student asks. And a crazy response.
Yeah. Oh, that I won't say is the crazy response.
Yeah. So, but the, you know, alive or dead is the,
yeah, right,
the crazy question.
Right.
And
right.
I won't say it's the very
yeah,
reasonable response. So I wonder if this student maybe heard too many. Not in the same way that I was encouraged to not get it into my head, but, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, every answer doesn't have to be, you know, plucking a flower or pouring out a cup of tea or, you know,
see
that. And, yeah, I did kind of resonate with me that, that encouragement that he didn't need to radically shift the student's mind.
Yeah.
So it just, slow down.
Yeah.
Well, it is kind of wonderful. There are lots of koans. I hope you encounter them all. you never will. They just endlessly, because even if you pass through hundreds, thousands of them, then you go back to some of the ones you passed. They're all new again. They're just, because it's the koan of our daily life. But just a little nerdy historical fact here is that some of the wildest teachers are more legendary teachers. And these people, we actually have some historical records that they lived in the 9th century, which is hundreds of years after Bodhidharma and, you know, and Wang Nang and some of these other more fictional or mythical people. And the fictional mythical people can sometimes appear really, you know, weird. when you encounter a koan from 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th century, there's something, often they're more complicated, like this one. You know, they're clear, there's a lot left out, there's a lot of very strange details that, you know, you wonder why is this, what's the deal with the ho, for example, you know, right? Isn't that great? And going from west to east and east to west, that's also a really interesting thing that he did, because you're always supposed to go from east to west and west to east in a Dharma hall in some, you know, some of the ways that we do the forms. So that he's all over the place, but it was recorded somehow that he was all over the place. Somebody else thought, wow, this guy. And that's what we get to benefit from, the feeling of, wow, this person said or did that. And the way it, you know, pulled on so many of our hearts in the room, in very different ways. If you remember what everything everybody said so far, nobody said the same thing yet. And I think that's also the juice, the fruit, the flowers of koans. They're personal and weird and sensible at some point. Yeah. So with that, we'll go back to our sitting